We sometimes talk about muscles like they're the special province of athletes and manual laborers, a gift granted by the fitness gods as a reward for those willing to work their bodies hard, day in and day out. In fact, even when we're sitting still, every moment of our lives, whether we are champion bodybuilders or couch potatoes, our survival depends on these remarkable tissues that respond to chemical and electrical signals to enable everything from blinking to breathing. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's always fascinating to take a deep dive into something that seems familiar. So I was excited to discover the newest book by UCLA clinical professor of orthopedic surgery, Dr. Roy Meals. It's called Muscle, the gripping story of strength and movement. Roy, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be back.
Let's start with a shout out to all the 27-year-olds listening, because this is the age at which muscle mass essentially peaks for most of us, after which we start losing muscle tissue. But there is plenty we can do to slow down that decline, right?
Right. Left to our own devices, just the hormonal changes and the scourge of time is that people will lose about 10% of muscle mass per decade for the rest of their life. And this can be reduced to 5% per decade with resistance training and aerobic exercises.
So ancient physicians and artists were interested in musculature for functional reasons and also aesthetic ones. For a long time, though, their progress in the West was hindered by the Catholic Church's proscription on human dissection. The only exception is if the cadaver was an executed criminal.
Right, that was held out to society as, you know, being the worst possible punishment. Not only condemned to death, but then have your body dissected in public. And that, so, like in the 13th to 15th century, is that the very early medical schools were allowed one dissection per year, and that was a public dissection, and attracted great interest from the general populace as well as from the doctors and anatomists.
So everybody has seen those drawings made by early artists showing muscles on a human form that was kind of just drawn without skin. Why was it such an important innovation when people started doing cross sections of muscle, say a slice of a human leg?
Well, actually, Leonardo toyed with that idea. Several of his sketches show cross sections through a thigh, and that because the anatomy is three dimensional, it's hard to represent in a drawing or a painting. And so I think that the very creative mind that he had, he was trying to display the three dimensionality of it. That was only sketches in his regard. The real step forward in cross-sectional anatomy came from Russia in the middle 1900s. Surgeon Nikolai Pirogov had ample supply of hard frozen bodies in Moscow during the winter, and that he spent several winters sawing through these bodies and then drawing the cross-sections, and came up with a very nice cross-sectional atlas. And then, of course, this anticipated by almost 150 years the development of computerized tomography, and then shortly thereafter magnetic resonance imaging, which we use to great advantage today to look at the anatomy throughout the body cross-sectionally, and then also be able to reconstructed in a three-dimensional format.
Where does the word muscle come from?
That's a good one. It's from the Latin word mus, which is the word for mouse, and that somebody early on saw the muscle rippling beneath the skin and likened that to a mouse.
What sort of electrical to chemical to mechanical action happens to muscles in order to generate movement?
That's an incredibly interesting and complex chain of events that starts in the brain with your idea to, let's say, close your fist. And then that message goes out from the brain into the spinal cord. As it goes into the spinal cord, it jumps from one nerve to another. And then a nerve goes all the way from your neck out to your muscles in your forearm. And at that point, there's a electrochemical synapse where the electricity releases some chemical mediators that then stimulate the muscle. These chemical mediators then go into the muscle and cause the mechanical contraction.
So many people who have lifted weights will have experienced the fact that, you know, you can be going along and it gets a little harder and a little harder. And by the end, by the final rep, you can't complete anymore. What is happening there? Is this simply about fatigue, or is this about the energy being delivered to the muscle?
Well, the for weightlifting is the chemical that finally converts this message to the mechanical sliding of the two protein components on each other, is that it's temporarily depleted. And so that goes behind the weightlifting concept of doing perhaps 12 reps and in the last rep getting close to the fatigue limit, because that's the last molecule of ATP that's available for the muscles. And then walk around for a minute or two, or do exercises for another muscle, and then the ATP will have been replenished, and you can maybe do another 10 or 12 reps before it's diminished again. But it's that stress on the muscle that then causes it to become stronger.
How does starvation or even something like crash dieting make us vulnerable to losing muscle mass?
Well, when the body first looks for carbohydrates, and they're easily accessed through our diet. And so if you're feeling hungry and you drink a Coke or have a candy bar, is that those carbohydrates are immediately accessible. When the body can't find the necessary carbohydrates to power all of its machinery, well, then it then looks to the fat stores. But that under crash dieting or starvation is that when the fat stores are gone, well, then the body says, well, I need to survive. And so then I'm going to start mobilizing protein. And the muscles molecules are proteins. And so that when you've seen people who are emaciated and have been starving for one reason or another, is that it looks like their skin is just draped on their skeleton, because their body has consumed protein at a last-ditch effort to survive.
How does the work that muscles do for lifting an object differ from the work of muscles that are simply holding that same object?
Well, a little bit of technical terminology. The first one is what we call an isotonic contraction, which means that the muscle has the same tone. So let's say you were lifting a book up off of a table and you bring the book up to your shoulder, is that you contract the muscle with enough force that you can lift the book. Whereas an isometric contraction, which iso means the same and metric means distance. And so isometric contraction is that the muscle is not actually shortening the skeleton, but it's just holding it at the position that it's in. So for instance, you could put your hand above your ear on the side of your head and then try to push your head and your hand together each other. Well, you know, your neck's not moving, your arm's not moving, but the muscles in your neck and the muscles in your arm are contracting. They're just not moving joints. So that's isotonic versus isometric contractions.
What is special about muscles that are sometimes under voluntary control and sometimes operate involuntarily?
Well, I mean, for instance, think about your blink reflex. Is that when you want to, you can blink your eyes, but that if foreign object is coming nearby, is that that's just an automatic response. Another one would be the upper esophageal sphincter, where the gastrointestinal tract in the throat meets the esophagus. That there's a sphincter there, a circular muscle that normally has that passageway closed off, and that it will involuntarily open as we swallow. We don't have to think about opening that sphincter, but that it will open automatically as we take a drink or swallow a bite of a food. But that to a certain extent, that can be trained to be under voluntary control. And the extreme example of that is sword swallowers, because they lean their head way back so that they get their gastrointestinal tract all the way from their mouth at, well into their stomach in a nice straight line, and then slide this sword down their throat. But that normally any of us would get a gag reflex on the upper esophageal sphincter, but they learn to control that voluntarily to be able to slide the sword into their stomach.
So we don't necessarily think as much about these muscles, but smooth muscles are essential for all kinds of bodily functions, including, I guess, virtually every aspect of the digestive system.
Absolutely. The smooth muscles in the stomach churn the food and mix the food with the enzymes. And then as this partially digested food passes from the stomach into the intestine, the smooth muscles in the small intestine through the mechanism of peristalsis, which are these rhythmic waves that will progressively move the food further down the intestinal tract, is that that's where the absorption of nutrients comes from. And then the smooth muscles continue all the way to the very end of the intestinal tract.
You quote a physician in the book who posited that the success of humans as a species owes as much to the sphincters of the large intestine as to our opposable thumbs. That is quite a claim. So maybe you can help us understand why he made it.
Well, it was done a little bit tongue in cheek, but he said that our anal sphincter was the smartest muscle in the body, because it could tell whether there was solid, liquid, or gas adjacent to it, and it knew whether we were in public or in private, and could appropriately then behave. That has amused anatomists and doctors for many years, and so I thought it'd be fun to include that in the book.
Well, when you put it that way, he's not wrong, and suddenly we can appreciate this part of our bodies in a way we make.
Oh, that's right. I mean, I think so much on a daily basis, when everything's functioning properly, we just take our bodies for granted, and it's only when we have a sore muscle or a failed organ of some sort is it then we really come to appreciate the body. So that's one of the things that I really tried to do in the book, was share my enthusiasm and amazement of the muscle system with the readers.
So, Chief, among those things we take for granted until a problem arises is the human heart. I mean, the fact that the heart beats as needed, responding to what our bodies require for our entire lives without stopping, is really amazing.
It's absolutely incredible. I mean, to think of a made machine, a toaster or a dishwasher or an automobile that, could potentially last 100, 115 years, but never take more than a second or two off, during that entire time, and then be flexible in terms of how much blood needs to be pumped, less at sleep and more when walking up steps. It is truly a remarkable and incredibly durable organ.
Is bodybuilding, for the sake of just getting as big as possible, is it good for the human body?
I suppose it depends on who you ask. These bodybuilders, they are monomaniacal about the size of their muscles and the work that they'll put in to get ready for a bodybuilding contest. And that normal body fat in somebody is in the maybe 22 to 28% range of total body weight. But these bodybuilders, in order to display their bulky muscles beneath their skin, is that in the several months leading up to a bodybuilding contest, will reduce their total body fat to the 6 to 8% range. And that's not only dangerous, but it's arduously hard to do that. And the bodybuilders that I've talked to say that for the last 4 to 6 weeks before a performance or a competition, is that their diet will be strictly white rice, white meat out of chicken and broccoli. And then for several days before the event, they will dehydrate themselves to even make the definition of their muscles more prominent beneath their skin. And that's not healthy. And the bodybuilders that I've talked to say that they can't actually compete more than 2 or 3 times a year because of the agony of getting their bodies in that shape. I'll tell you a fun story. But when I started writing the book, I decided that I should walk the walk. And so I've always hated lifting weights, but that I said, okay, for the book, I'm going to hire a personal trainer. And so when he came and he looked at me and realized I was a senior citizen, he asked me what my goals were. I said, well, I'm writing this book and I want to learn as much as I can. And, you know, I want to look good and be as strong as I can. And said, you know, I think it'd be fun if I could show a six pack. And he just laughed at me and he says, Roy, your six pack is in there. It's just covered up. And I am not about to, I'm not about to drop my body fat to 6 or 8% just to demonstrate a six pack.
Yeah. So we've all got so one down all, in there somewhere.
We all have it.
Roy, what is the benefit of stretching our muscles, and is it best to do this before or after we exercise?
Muscles should be warm, because I think if we've had the experience of jumping out of the back seat of a car, having sat in there for a couple hours, is that our muscles aren't immediately responsive. Certainly that's the case with me getting out of the bed first thing in the morning, is that those first several steps are a little bit problematic. And so stretching a cold muscle is dangerous, and you're liable to pull it and create a tear and bleeding into it, and soreness and inflammation that's going to set you back for weeks. And so before any sort of exercise, warming up is good, and getting more circulation out to the muscles and helping them just get to be their normal pliability. And then at the end of the exercise session, during the cool down, that would be the time to stretch them. To a certain extent, you're stretching the muscles and their tendon attachments, but that you're also giving the joint capsules and the ligaments, which attach the bone to the bone, to give them a good stretch when they're nice and warm.
So the companies that want to sell me expensive leggings for working out often tout the compression features of their garments. I may or may not be drawn to compression for the way it makes me look, but does compression actually help muscles function better?
The people who spend the money on them think they do, but there's no science to that whatsoever. I think that's a passing fad. Hmm.
We should talk about the term muscle memory. I think a lot of people think about it as like, after we learn how to type or ride a bike, we don't have to think very hard about doing those motions. But there's another phenomenon, right, which is that people who've been pretty fit can recover muscle faster after inactivity than people who were not so fit before?
Right. That's under current investigation, and not a whole lot is known about that, but that muscle that has been trained and then, you know, is, I guess you'd say, deconditioned, is that it does seem to respond faster to retraining in terms of gaining strength. And so that should be encouraging anybody who, say, you know, maybe has to take time off because of a sprained ankle or total knee replacement or backache or anything like that, is to know that when they do get back into an exercise program, is that their muscles that know that they had previously been strong, and that they will likely recover their previous strength more rapidly than an entirely untrained muscle.
How important are strong and healthy muscles in maintaining balance, especially as we get older?
Oh, incredibly important in that, you know, the American, American Society of Sports Medicine, they advise that everybody does resistance training on two non-consecutive days, but then also do aerobic exercises on 3 or 4 days at least, to the extent of maybe 150 minutes a week. And then in addition, people should work on maintaining their balance, because balance not only requires good coordination and nerve activity coming from the brain and coming out the spinal cord, but that for the these nerves to then affect themselves in balance, you have to have muscles that are going to support you. If you get slightly off balance, then you want to have a muscle that's strong enough to bring you back into a line. One easy way to practice your balance, and which I try to do, is stand on one leg while I'm brushing my teeth. And so I'm not spending any extra time with my balance, but I'll first try to stand on one leg for 30 seconds and then stand on the other leg and go back and forth like that. And if you think you're really good at doing that, well, then try closing your eyes while standing on one leg. But yes, it is very important, particularly as people get older, to work on maintaining the coordination and strength necessary to have balance. And so if you happen to stumble on something, you're more likely to recover rather than fall and possibly do yourself dire damage.
Let's talk about nutrition. I am frankly astonished by some of the recommendations I see for how much protein is optimal for a human to consume to stay healthy and, you know, power through a workout. How can we know we're getting enough protein? And, like, is there such a thing as too much protein?
I don't know that there's I don't know there's an issue about too much protein, but that it would finally get boring. I think you'd get full on food that really wasn't maybe as satisfying as if you had a slightly lower protein diet. And some of the things that make protein difficult to understand is that oftentimes they'll say, well, you should have grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And when you say kilogram to an American, most all of us get kind of starry-eyed, and what the hell is that? And so in the book, I did the simple math to convert kilograms into pounds, and that it works out that a maintenance diet to just for an average person, you need 4 grams of protein per 10 pounds of body weight. If you want to be fit and be moderate in your exercise program, both aerobics and resistance training, well, then you should plan on about 6 grams per 10 pounds of body weight. And if you're really into bodybuilding and want to get the most strength and bulk out of your muscles, then you should go to 7 or 7.5 grams of protein per 10 pounds of body weight. And then, of course, it's easy to determine from reading the labels on packaged food or on the internet. You can easily find how much protein is in various food products. And it's not hard at all to have a interesting and varied diet, even if it's entirely vegetarian, and get that 6 grams of protein per 10 pounds of body weight.
Is it okay to get some of that from protein powders and supplements, or should it really come from whole food?
No, the protein powder is good. Usually that's, I think that, yeah, you can, the protein powder that I use has 80 grams of protein in it, and it has about 120 calories. So it's not terribly caloric. And so that might be something to think about if you're worried about the number of calories that you're taking in. You might be able to get more protein per calorie with the powder. Well, you mentioned supplements. You may have a question about this, but I just want to say that for people who want to build strength, is that the supplement creatinine is well proven and considered universally considered safe as far as a supplement that will help with muscles. But that all these other supplements that you can find in the health food store and are touted on the internet and so forth, there's no good science that any of them actually help. Essentially amino acid supplements, all sorts of variety of things. They're nutraceuticals. The companies make big money on them, and they highly tout them, but there's no good science to support that they actually are doing you any good.
What should we do, Roy, when our muscles are sore because we strain them?
It's interesting that as common as delayed onset muscle soreness is, that very little is known about it scientifically. The knee-jerk response is that, well, it's a buildup of lactic acid, and we know that acids sting, and the chemical reaction that causes muscle contraction does generate lactic acid, but that lactic acid is converted to other molecules within just a minute or so after the end of exercise, and so it is not a buildup of lactic acid that'll make us sore a day or two later. If we were going to study it, we'd have to do biopsies out of humans. And I personally do not want to have my quadriceps biopsied just because it was sore from, doing an extra set of lunges 2 days ago. So the fact that willing volunteers are hard to come by, and the fact that there's really no money to support it, and that's appropriate because, the research money should be going for life-threatening diseases. So I think the mystery of delayed onset muscle soreness. Now, you talked about muscle strain, and that's where I consider that, the muscle is just really suddenly stretched and some of the fibers are torn, and that muscle will be sore until the bleeding and the inflammation tissue and the scar tissue all settles down. And of course, that's not nearly as common as the delayed onset muscle soreness, and for that, basically, one needs to just be nice to that muscle and not re-injure it until it can heal.
I can't let you go without asking why sometimes our muscles are not nice to us. In the middle of the night, we're sleeping and we get a foot cramp or a calf cramp, or sometimes just, going about our days. What causes that to happen?
Once again, nobody knows for sure. And it's one of those things that is understudied, and maybe even more than delayed onset muscle soreness, is the cramps are so transient that you probably don't want to sleep in a muscle cramp lab and then have the researcher run over in the middle of the night and say, oh yeah, you're having cramp. Let's biopsy it right now. Some people think that's coming from the brain. Some people think that's coming from where the nerve joins the muscles. Some people think that that's in the muscle itself. One interesting bit of research that I came across was in management of cramps, is that there was one study where they had the subjects fatigue their muscles in the lab under controlled circumstances, and then they would have half of them quickly swallow an ounce of pickle juice. And then they had a placebo group that had a sham pickle juice, but it was colored and flavored such that you couldn't tell who was getting the control and who was getting the real pickle juice. But that the people who bolted that ounce of pickle juice had their cramps resolve more quickly. And that says that, when the response is that quick, it can't be something metabolic in the muscle itself, because it would take, at least 10 or 20 seconds for the pickle juice to get into the stomach and be absorbed in the stomach, get in the blood and go to the muscle, so that they think that maybe that's more of a nervous autonomic reaction. But once again, muscle cramps are probably going to remain an enigma for a long time.
Dr. Roy Meals is clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA, and his newest book is called Muscle, The Gripping Story of Strength and Movement. Roy, so nice to speak with you again. Thank you for making time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.